It's time to talk about Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. And now, here's Ira.
There's all kinds of books on gaming, from a history of Atlantic City to biographies of some of the pioneers of Las Vegas to a profile of the Sands to a complete history of gambling itself. And it seems as if one author wrote them all. And he did. Now that same author has turned to history again and is writing about the casinos in Las Vegas and how Las Vegas became America's gambling capital. David G. Schwartz is author of Something for Your Money, A History of Las Vegas Casinos. The book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about David, go to dgschwartz.com and follow him on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and X. And David, welcome back to the show. It's been a few years.
Yeah, it's great to see you again.
Thanks for coming on. I'm delighted that you have another book, and it's out now. And it's called Something for Your Money, A History of Las Vegas Casinos. Where did that phrase Something for Your Money come from? I understand it was a Las Vegas gaming pioneer, Jim McIntosh. And how did you find that for the
book? Yeah, Jim McIntosh owned the Arizona Club, which is going back, you know, this is before there was gambling in Fremont Street. This was back in the Block 16 days. So right after Las Vegas was formed. And that was the slogan of the Arizona Club, Something for Your Money. And I thought that really was Vegas because it's very clear that you're going to be giving us money. It's up to your imagination what you're going to get back. And I think that just perfectly describes Vegas and the appeal of casinos.
Right. And it spans decades as well. I know you wrote on your blog, which again is at dgschwartz.com. Here's what you wrote. Quote, you could say that Something for Your Money is my way of summing up everything I've been writing about Las Vegas for the past 25 years. It starts with the founding of Las Vegas and ends with the closings of the Tropicana and Mirage, end quote. That's a pretty encompassing look at Las Vegas.
Yeah, you know, this is, like I said, something I've been studying and researching for a long time. So it's really great to get something out there that sums up what I'm feeling about and where it's all gone.
How did you start that particular process? Because again, it's not one resort or one casino, yeah, or one hotel. It's obviously all of them. So how did you start that process? You obviously clearly have a bank of information and news from your research over all the books you've written. And I recommend people go to your website at dgschwartz.com because David has a ton of books on this subject. But how did you set up this process for researching and writing it?
It came out of a couple areas. First was I used to write feature pieces for Vegas 7 magazine. It was a great local weekly that was around for about 7 or 8 years and then disappeared. And a lot of things that I've written weren't available anymore because the magazine went away, so they weren't available to anybody. And I thought, well, I did work really hard in researching that and people seem to like it, so wouldn't it be great to have that still be available? So that was one thing. Second was a lot of people saying, yeah, but I don't want to read about the history of casinos and other places. I just want to read about Vegas, you know, just about Vegas. So that's why I said, you know what, I can take some of these things I've already written and then do some more research in the archives and places like that and have a pretty decent history of casinos in Vegas.
Well, when you started that, as I mentioned earlier, you have such a bank of knowledge to begin with to work on, and I'm sure you went down some rabbit holes as well. What was the most surprising thing you found in your research? Was it about a particular casino, or was it just in general how Las Vegas has changed over the decades?
I think part of it was the mob story, which I know everybody knows is there, but it's amazing how it was there. It wasn't really commented on. Then for a little while, it was commented on a lot, and then it sort of went away and came back as the almost nostalgia. So that was fascinating to see how organized crime shaped a lot of things in Vegas with the casinos.
And did that start in the 40s, right, rather than the 50s? People generally
Associate
the 50s, but it was really the 40s.
Yeah, and it did really, you know, as there Kefauver Committee obviously was a big deal because there was more prohibition around the country. So a lot of the money and a lot of the people started to come to Las Vegas. That really did kick it off. And I have a chapter about Kefauver in the book, which I think is great. You know, as you know, the Mob Museum has that original courtroom where they did the hearings. That's preserved. A great thing if you've never been there to go. So I thought it was good to have that in this book. So people have that context when they go to the Mob Museum. Hey, here's what actually happened on that day.
Because you're going back so far in time, I'm assuming that obviously some of the people that were there at the beginning, well, not some, all of the people there at the beginning are no longer around, but they have descendants, they have heirs, they have associates, relatives, et cetera, that may still be around. Were you able to talk to people and not necessarily get an oral history, but sit down with people to get a flavor of some of the eras that you wrote about, some of the casinos that you wrote about?
For the feature pieces that I'd worked on that got incorporated into the book, yes. Mm-hmm. For the book, I didn't do too much original interview, because some of the stuff I did, some of the new research for the book was in the teens and 20s and 30s when there really wasn't anybody still left. And a lot of it was drawing in that other, like you said, bank of research that I'd already uncovered.
This is just inside baseball stuff, but I'm finding it interesting. Yeah. Is because you've done so much research over the decades, I've known you forever, that how did you organize it? So when you decided to write this book, you were able to go back to your records and files. Most of it is probably digital at this point, and find what you needed. Was it organized a certain way?
Yeah, I like to keep little folders of digital stuff. So it might be Stardust, Tropicana, you know, and just as I see stuff, file it in there. So then when it came time to write about the Stardust, I'll go to my Stardust folder. And then, well, what's not here? Okay, well, I'm going to have to do a new search and look that up too.
Was special collections at UNLV a help? I know the reason I ask you that, because knowing of your association with that part of UNLV has been for many years. Were you able to find stuff you didn't realize was there?
Yeah, they were really helpful. And again, I'm always amazed at the depth of information they have and the amount of holdings they have. And there's some really great hidden treasures there.
When you decided to put the book together, was there the thought that, and you mentioned this in your blog about how Las Vegas is the gambling capital of the world. And not only did they achieve it, they maintained it, especially with competition. It's so funny to think back now with worrying about competition from Atlantic City when, in fact, competition is global at this stage, and yet Las Vegas maintains it. Is there one theme that you found in your research and in your writings for the book? And again, it's called Something for Your Money, A History of Las Vegas Casinos. Was there a theme or a thread that unified it all for you?
I think two of them. First of all, it's the something for your money idea, where a lot of Las Vegas was built on marketing, was built on promotion, was built on PR. And the second thread was innovation and not being sentimental about things, where it's just change, 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 change. You know, I look at the background behind you there and you think 20 years ago, a lot of that wasn't here. 50 years ago, I don't think any of it was here. What I'm looking, well, the Flamingo, but probably not those towers. Yeah.
Listener.
So yeah, I mean, that just shows you how innovative Las Vegas is, how there's this imperative for change.
For our listeners, David is looking at my background, so that's
yes,
a reference point. Because you've become such a prolific author of gaming books, and that's not just, as I mentioned in my opening, it's about individual pioneers, it's about the city itself, Atlantic City included. Of course, you've written a book, The History of Gambling. I mean, it's quite extensive. Do you find yourself surprised at all about the growth of Las Vegas after all this time?
It's amazing when you step back and go into that deep, deep dive into the archives and you read what they were talking about in 1950 or 1960 and how fearful people were that this wasn't going to succeed. You know, that really does give you a sense of how amazing it was that Las Vegas has maintained this success for so long, because there were, at many points, there were very, very real fears that maybe it wasn't going to last. That always amazes me.
Well, the fact that, too, and we're in the middle of a desert here.
Yeah.
And so, yes, Los Angeles is nearby. It's our primary market. But even so, it always fascinates me. We're in the middle of in the desert, yet we have food, water, entertainment, recreation, and an exploding population, and soon more film production and more other industries. Somehow we were able to do it. Is there a, and go back to my thread concept, is there a thread among some of the gaming pioneers or tourism officials or others? The, obviously, we talk about the private partner, the private-public partnership. Were all these elements part of where we are today?
Yeah, and I think what set Las Vegas apart was the idea that, okay, we've got a canvas in the desert south of San Francisco Street, as it used to be known. Now it's Sahara. And hey, if you have money and want to play, come on and play. And the same thing happened on Fremont Street, where, okay, hey, you think you can do better than the people here? Give it a shot. And you know, later we see the same thing with neighborhood casinos, where, okay, you want to build a casino, go ahead and do it. So that really is where a lot of it comes from, I think.
Would Las Vegas be Las Vegas without the gambling? What I mean by that is we've talked about there's entertainment, there's retail, there's dining, fine dining, explosion of that in the last 15 years. There's the conventions. Would any of that be here if it were not for the basic level of gambling that was offered at that point?
Probably not, because when Las Vegas was developing, when the casinos were developing, gaming really was a novelty. So you couldn't do that everywhere. So that was the hook to get people here, because you could see shows at other nightclubs around the country. You could have meals at other places. You know, obviously you could do shopping too, and a lot of times better. So gambling really did kickstart the development of Las Vegas, you know, as a tourist area. And I think at this point, you know, someday could it do without gambling? Maybe, but it's still going to be a really important part of the identity, just because that still is what people think of.
What was the most emotional part of writing this book? And maybe there wasn't one, but you're a fairly level-headed guy. You're a scholar. You've written a lot of books objectively as well. But was there one thing about what you found that hit you emotionally, whether it was a person or a resort or a casino?
Yeah, you know, and this developed out of a feature story I wrote for Vegas 7 when the Riviera closed. And I did a piece talking about the history of the Riviera, but also talking to some of the employees. And what are they going to do now that it's closing? And that, you know, that really resonated with me, because growing up in Atlantic City as a kid, like, oh, the casinos will be there forever. And then a lot of them closed. And then you see a place like the Riviera, like, oh, yeah, this place has been around here since 1955. It's never going away. It goes away. Same thing with the Tropicana. Same thing with the Mirage. So it does give you that, you know, that idea that, hey, you know, this, there's real people's lives are really wound up in all this.
Was it a shock to you when the Mirage went away?
I wouldn't say it was a shock. It was surprising, you know, and I'm not going to say that it's my favorite decision that anybody's made in Las Vegas, just because it is such a historic property, you know, and it's the place that really did, I don't want to say revive casinos in the Strip, but definitely change the way how they look. You know, at the same time, the thing that set Las Vegas apart is not being sentimental about things. So in a way, it's the perfect fate for it, is that it is rethemed and renovated.
Well, a favorite buzzword these days seems to be the word elevate. And I think the Mirage at the time that it was built elevated Las Vegas to another level that you didn't have before.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. That really was what it did. And I think it not only did it do that from a design point of view, it showed that a casino like that could make a lot of money, which meant a lot of other people followed it. So if you hadn't had the Mirage, Las Vegas would still be very big and successful, but it would look a lot different.
Yeah. When the Tropicana went down, and that was more emotional for me than it would have been for you, still, it was built in 1957. And the Follies came in 1959, and you always thought it was going to be there. Yes, it changed the exterior look several times, but it was always there. And now it's not. So is any casino, from your research and knowledge, is any casino safe from, I don't know what the word would be, moving forward, I guess?
I don't think so, because I think at the moment where they decide we can make more money if we do X, the casino goes away. And that's just the way it is. You know, if this happened to the Mirage, it could happen to Caesar's Palace. It could happen to Bellagio. It could happen to a lot of places. You know, maybe it will someday. You know, but at the time, yeah, you know, I imagine with your connection to the Tropicana, that must have been very emotional because you figure it's always going to be there.
Yeah. And then one day it's not.
Yeah.
Oh, I did get a chance to tour it one last time before it was imploded, which was great. The book is called Something for Your Money, A History of Las Vegas Casinos. When you broke up each chapter with a story about each casino, was there any casino that was significantly different than the other casinos? Was one so of an outlier that you had to write about it in a different way?
Caesar's Palace was a little bit different because I'd written a whole book about the founding of Caesar's Palace. So that was much more focused on, hey, everything that happened after it opened in 1966 and kind of taking that long look of some of the other ones. And it also was such an interesting property because it became a brand and I think was the first casino to really become a brand. And probably to a big extent, a lot of casinos wish they could have that brand identity that Caesars had. So that one definitely felt different for me.
It seems it's also one of the, if not the first, one of the first themed resorts as well.
Yeah. And one of the first to be really globally identifiable, where if you went anywhere in the world, I feel that people would know Caesars Palace is a casino. And I don't know that you can say that for all the other casino names, but yeah. I'm not going to fight any branding people on that, but that's just my hunch.
Was it hard to write objectively about these casinos, knowing you have the background you do? So you went into some deep research. Were there some surprising things you found out about a particular casino that you didn't know and that threw you off a little bit?
It's things that I didn't know. A lot of it is just focusing on things like the intricacy of some of the slot skimming schemes that were going on and appreciation for how intelligent the people who created them were, you know, but also like, well, I guess they weren't that intelligent because they did get caught. So there's that aspect of this is something really interesting that you couldn't see happening. There's also that appreciation for how Las Vegas would take pretty much anything and try to make it in, you know, the lemons from lemonade thing. I think maybe one of my favorite chapters to write, and they were all my favorite when I was writing them, but as I look back at it, the chapter about the atomic testing was just a lot of fun to write because on one hand, we have literal weapons of mass destruction going off 70 miles away. There's some panic at first, but then they say, well, maybe this could be a tourist attraction, and it becomes a big one.
Right.
People love it. And to me, that also does say something there where, you know, we're going to have, and I've got there's a great picture in the book that I got from the LVCVA News Bureau archives of people at I believe it was at the New Frontier, might have been another casino, but basically they're having fun in the pool and behind them you can see a mushroom cloud. It's just like, oh yeah, yeah. Just an average day, yeah.
Different
vacation.
Different day
mushroom
and time,
cloud, right? In the background, yeah. We're just having fun at the pool, which is, I don't know, definitely 20 years before you wouldn't have seen that because atomic weapons weren't invented. 20 years after, I think the health concerns were there. So I feel like that for that brief window of time, Las Vegas was right on the front lines for that.
Do you touch on entertainment in writing the book? I haven't had a chance to read it all, but
yeah.
Do you touch on entertainment in certain aspects of some casinos? Because entertainment is always an important part of a casino, yeah. But not all casinos. Some are grind joints or just they're there for the slots and the table games and food, but not entertainment per se.
Yeah, definitely. You look at some like the Sands, that was a big differentiator. And of course, the Rat Pack is pretty famous from there. I think the other one that really stands out to me is Elvis at the International in Hilton. You know, and that's where to this day, the property has a lot of their identity mm-hmm. around that. And I think that just goes to show how big it was. And I think I really enjoyed looking at some of those News Bureau photographs from that time, which really drove home just how big a deal it was when Elvis was in town. And I think now we're jaded because we have these world-renowned superstars performing every week, but it, you could really see there's something special when Elvis was in town.
It was also a smaller town too, so it had more of an impact.
Yeah.
And there wasn't the an entertainment competition, and there wasn't as big of a city at that point. And one thing that, that when you write about casinos, there's always the element of, from the house perspective, of greed. And what I mean by that is that you mentioned about organized crime, greed, and even in today's world, there's elements where the gaming commission or gaming control would have to get involved and tidy things up a bit. Do you think that's always going to be a situation here in Las Vegas?
Yeah, you know, I think there's always that balancing act. And there's the bigger one to me is how player friendly are the casinos. And there's that, you know, tightrope to walk to that has to be walked between, well, if we give too many comps away, give too much away, a lot of casinos have gone bankrupt. If we don't give enough away, people might go somewhere else. So that's also one of the tensions I've seen as time has gone on.
I think you should have done a whole chapter on the history of paid parking in Las Vegas.
I've got to say, in my years of studying Las Vegas and, you know, talking to people about Las Vegas, the one issue that got people angry when I would do a talk and take questions afterwards was paid parking in the Strip. People were livid about that for about 3 years. Absolutely livid. So, yes, I agree with you. Agree with you.
That could be a whole book. I think the next Dora Schwartz book is going to be on paid parking in Las Vegas. Well, it's a downfall.
It does show how the shifting ownership, and this is one of the themes of the book, affects the casinos, where now the owners have a fiduciary responsibility to drive shareholder value. So it's not that, oh, I'm greedy and I want to make money for myself. If they don't do it, they're going to get sued for not doing their duty to maximize revenues for the shareholders. So the system's kind of set up for that kind of stuff now.
On the other hand, though, let's say that you have all these, there's not that many corporations on the Strip in terms of the actual ownership. So you could theoretically offer free parking while your competitors don't and make up the revenue on people coming there to gamble that way.
I think so too. That's the problem that I think with that is it's not going to be as easy to see where they can see, okay, we made this amount from parking. It's really hard to trace that back. Okay, because of the goodwill that we engendered from not having parking, which I think everybody agrees would be there. You know, as a local, I'd probably be way more happy going somewhere and not having to say, well, I've got to get out in 3 hours. And if I'm going out of the show now, I'm going to get charged $40 because I was out in 3 hours and 5 minutes and not, you know, those kinds of things. I could see people way more wanting to go to the Strip. I don't know enough about Wall Street to know how you make that presentation to the board of directors, though. But maybe that's the way it goes. Because I think the other thing that the book has taught me is that it is about what the customers want, and they've got to listen to them. And when they don't, they do go away.
What's the biggest takeaway you would like readers to take away? I'm redundant here from your new book.
I think an appreciation, a thing that I'm fascinated with is just how interesting the history has been and just how many things have been tried in the past many times, and they seem to go in cycles. So a lot of times things that we might think are really new, well, they did it before. So maybe kind of taking a read through this and maybe then doing a deep dive into some of the newspaper archives might give some folks some ideas.
I want to ask you one more question, though, before I let you go. What's the future for David G. Schwartz? I know that you talk about it in your blog, that you're going to go in a different direction. Do you want to share what that different direction is yet, or do you want to keep it closely held?
I've got a couple things I'm working on. Hopefully in 2025 we'll pan out and I'll have something to talk about. But right now I'm kind of keeping things open. Not sure if I'll do another history book. Maybe something in fiction, maybe something on a different topic. Who knows? But I've definitely got a couple things I'm looking into now.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been David G. Schwartz. He's author of Something for Your Money, A History of Las Vegas Casinos. The book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about David, go to dgschwartz.com. That's dgschwartz.com. And follow him on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and X. And Dave, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thanks so much, Ira. It's been great.
You got it. See you next time.
You've been listening to Talk About Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. Hey, Las Vegas.